Welcome to Line by Line Bible Studies. My name is Paul Stringini. We're on the book of Isaiah, chapter 33, verse 1. Woe to thee that spoilest, and thou wast not spoiled, and dealest treacherously, and they dealt not treacherously with thee. When thou shalt cease to spoil, thou shalt be spoiled. And when thou shalt make an end to deal treacherously, they shall deal treacherously with thee. This is the sixth of six woes in Isaiah. And woe to them that build house and house and lay field to field. Woe to the land shadowing with wings, and so on. Here we have woe to the spoiler who is not spoiled. A lot of times people will do things out of vengeance, and there's a sort of an understanding of why. It's very common to return tit for tat, eye for eye. When someone does wrong to you, it's very natural to take vengeance on them. It's just the way that is very easy. And it's very sympathetic. A lot of people have a lot of sympathy. You know, if you watch a movie where someone has all kinds of things taken from him, treachery, and then they are, treacherous back to the treacherous dealers, it seems only fair. And that's kind of what it's saying here is, you're spoiling people who didn't spoil you. You're dealing treacherously with people who were not treacherous with you. And he said, when you're done, you're going to be spoiled. You're going to be dealt treacherously with. In the world, you can only lay up so much treachery and so much evil for yourself before it comes right back down on your head. As Christians, we should not be treacherous dealers. And when it says this, like I said, there's a sense of sort of vengeance here. But it's the vengeance of the Lord. The Lord is always right when he takes vengeance. So, I've had people talk to me about God, and they questioned that. They said, well, how can God do these things? How can he punish people? They compare him to the worst sorts of humans. Like to a bully or a dictator or to a tyrant. And my response is always, God is much more than a tyrant. He's God. And if anyone ever had a sense of objective truth, it's God. God is the only one who can justify every single one of his actions based on his unlimited knowledge. Someone told me to kill a child. I wouldn't do that. But if God told you to kill a child, they would say, well, then you would do it, wouldn't you? I say, well, if it's God, he may have a good reason. I've heard people say, oh, I'd like to go back in time and kill Hitler before he got to do all those bad things. People say stuff like that. Before he'd ever done anything, you'd actually do that? Because, I know what's going to happen. Oh, you know what they're really all about. You know what that person is really made of. So with that knowledge of what's going to happen and also of the character of that person that was revealed, you can justify destroying them, or you feel you can. Well, God has all that knowledge before we do anything. He knows our character. And really, as far as humans go, there's not a just man who isn't a recipient of God's grace. If God were to judge us by the standards if God were to judge us by the standards of his son's righteousness, no man's going to measure up. There were men in the Old Testament who God regarded as righteous, right? Abraham believed God and it was imputed to him for righteousness. But that doesn't mean he was as righteous as Christ was. So when God takes vengeance, it is righteous. Because God is the ultimate arbitrator of justice and of truth. So when he brings his hammer down on the wicked, it is entirely justified. Treachery is such a malevolent evil in this world. There's no more awful feeling than when you've been dealt with in a treacherous way, when you've been deceived. If someone's played on your confidence, they've taken you in and been treacherously, well, they've spoiled you, they've taken things from you. I know that feeling of having something taken from me by treachery and deceit. And God does not look on that. No, who cares? The Lord says, woe unto you. Men always think, oh, who sees us? Who knows us? But God does see. And their judgment does not linger long. It's coming. In this life, yes, and then they will stand before the judge. Verse 2. O Lord, be gracious unto us. We have waited for thee. Be thou their arm every morning, our salvation, also in the time of trouble. We need God's grace. People think the grace of God is merely a New Testament phenomenon, that the Jews in the Old Testament, they had to obey God. And they did have to obey God. But that does not mean that God didn't have to be gracious to them. God does not have to, like the sacrificial system, that's grace. Because God doesn't have to accept the blood of animals for men's sins. In fact, you know, even in Isaiah, he says, I'm sick of this. I'm sick of your animal sacrifices and stuff. I want you to be righteous. I want you to execute judgment. I don't want your animal sacrifices. I don't want those things. That's not what I want. What God wants out of his people is uprightness, righteousness, holiness. He wants our character to be molded into that form, which brings about peace, which is not treacherous, which gives him the impulse to bless us rather than to bring about our punishment. But no matter what the case, humans are frail, they're fallible, and even the best of us need God to cut us some slack. So we wait for the Lord. We are those who wait upon God. We call upon his name that he would bless us with his salvation and with his righteousness. We call upon him for these things, and we need him to be gracious in that. Because he could just be judgmental over us also. It would be entirely justified. That's what a lot of people don't understand. They think that somehow God owes man something. He owes us nothing more than he owes the animal kingdom. Really. Because though we look at ourselves and we say, well, we're kind of close to the beast, but we're actually very significantly above them. And we're made in the image of God. We have this consciousness that exceeds their form of consciousness. We have these minds, this language, all these powers we have. We have the word. We can speak the word like God does. We can create things, bring them into existence, new things, ideas, at least new to us and new to the world. We can do all those things. So we are not like the beasts, yet we are so much like the beasts, especially when compared to God. God is so much more above us. Consider relative to how much we're above the animals, we're much closer to the animals than we are to God. What is it they say that our DNA is 90%+ similar to many animals? And much higher than that, you know. I question that because I always think like, well, you know, the devil's in the details. You know, 1% or less of a difference in a huge undertaking. You know, you talk about a book. You know, I could take this Bible, and by changing 1% of it, I could make a huge difference, depending on where I make those changes. So, anyways. And then the request is made. The plea, be thou their arm every morning. What does it mean? That's an idiom, right? To be, or a metaphor, to be the arm. The arm is the strength and that active portion of power that you put forth to execute your works in the world, your arm. And the arm of the Lord is the same thing, but that he would be our arm, our strength, that we put forth to do all our works. And in the morning we would get up, that our arms would be strengthened with the strength of God and our salvation. Also in the time of trouble. Troubles come, and we need salvation. We need God to be our salvation. Because that's a powerful salvation. And I'm not just talking about ultimate salvation of our souls and the resurrection of the dead, which is important, but also in the time of trouble. We need to be saved. We need to be saved when temptation comes. We need to be saved when we have financial difficulties or whatever. Or whatever's coming against us. You know, whatever would come either to destroy our livelihood or to take our lives. All kinds of things are going to come against us to bring us into captivity, into bondage, or to other forms of, you know, when you go into a dark place. We need to be delivered from drugs and alcohol, from sexual addictions. We need to be delivered from all our hatred and envy and the strife we bring about between our brothers. We need to be delivered from the treacherous dealers. We need to be saved from the treacherous dealers and from the spoilers who would spoil us. And then we call upon God to do that, that he would be gracious to us. We are waiting for him. Be gracious, Lord, we have waited. That's all we can say. We have not turned our backs on God, you know. And for him, that is, well, we are looking to him and longing after his righteousness. We seek the peace which God brings, the peace which passes understanding. We bow before him and before none others, before none of the things of this world, nor of the images of this world, but before God alone. Verse 3, at the noise of the tumult, the people fled. At the lifting up of thyself, the nations were scattered. And your spoil shall be gathered like the gathering of the caterpillar, as the running to and fro of locusts shall he run upon them. The Lord is exalted, for he dwelleth on high. He hath filled Zion with judgment and righteousness. And wisdom and knowledge shall be the stability of thy times, and strength of salvation. The fear of the Lord is his treasure. It's quite a bit there, but I think that all kind of comes together. At the noise of the tumult, there's trouble coming. In life, there's always trouble. There's always some trouble. There's always people causing trouble. There's always nature causing trouble. There's trouble. There's going to be trouble, no matter what. There'll be troublesome times, wars, rumors of wars, disasters, all kinds of things. Not to mention the end of the world, which is not even worth mentioning half the time because, you know, people start thinking about the end of the world. They start getting the wrong idea, like they don't have to prepare for any trouble because we have that rapture teaching going around, which makes people think, well, you know, it's coming any time and everything's pretty good, so I don't need to worry about trouble. And I'm not saying you ought to worry about trouble. If you're leaning on the Lord, you don't have to worry about trouble. But when the tumult comes, the people will flee. When the trouble comes, people, they descend into chaos, and they begin behaving treacherously and like animals. That's what people, they will be, do whatever it takes to survive. Not all people, but a great number of people. At the lifting up of thyself, the nations were scattered. When God rises up, for what? For judgment, and for punishing, and for bringing the trouble. Remember in Isaiah, the trouble God brings is the Assyrians coming to invade Israel, to destroy the northern kingdom and carry them all away captive, and to whittle the southern kingdom down to just a little bit. He comes against all the defense cities of Judah and takes them away captive. Not utterly like with the northern kingdom, where it becomes no longer a people. And three score and four years shall Israel be broken, that it be not a people, is what Isaiah had said. Within 65 years, is what he had said, shall Ephraim be broken, that it be not a people. Nationally, there never was an Israel again, that northern kingdom. Even the kingdom that is there now, or the democracy, is called Israel. But it is still the Jews, because that was the southern kingdom, the kingdom of Judah. Anyways, but back to this. God brings up trouble and the nations are scattered because their power is nothing before him. All our powers are nothing before the powers that God can bring against us. Our nations, the peoples, the smaller units, they are all easily swept away by the forces which are in play in this world. Forces of nature and forces of human discontent, revolution. Or of the when he puts the hooks in their jaws to draw them forth to war. The caterpillar here is another name for the locust, at least in a different form. Maybe the pupa or something, I'm not sure. I just remember from Joel doing research that there's different names, and the caterpillar is one. It doesn't matter. What it means is your spoil should be gathered like the gathering of the caterpillar. Like locusts, they're going to run to and fro. What's that mean? They're going to eat it all up. You ever watch a caterpillar take down a leaf? You know, or a ravenous plague, so to speak, gosh, I'm thinking about last year. I had a major infestation of Japanese beetles all over one of my trees. And I went out there, and they were just everywhere, and they were just eating away at the leaves. I mean, they're just absolutely everywhere and so destructive. And the way I dealt with them is I literally took them off. I just picked them all off by the handful and drowned them in a bucket. And this is speaking to the ubiquity that comes about. Ubiquity means it's like everywhere. I just like that word, ubiquitous, you know. And the ubiquity of the, because the way locusts kind of get all over everything and their sheer numbers makes it just so difficult to deal with. And so when God brings about his judgment, sometimes it can be so overwhelming. It's like insects. You can't get them all. Yeah, I mean, you can't deal with these numbers. And the troubles that God can bring when the world becomes full of treachery and wickedness, the response to that can be very severe, and it can be so all-encompassing that it is very difficult to deal with because of the all-encompassing nature. The Lord is exalted, for he dwelleth on high. He hath filled Zion with judgment and righteousness. That by bringing about God's judgment, sometimes that's what it takes, to inspire judgment and righteousness. He's got to send judgment against the evildoers and sever them from among the just. Or at least punish us all to the degree where we start looking at ourselves and saying, like, what did we do wrong? Because, you know, when you have corruption in government, when you have all these things, it's not, I know a lot of times there's dictatorships that are very powerful and very difficult to control. But, you know, even those dictatorships, they're depending on a level of power underneath them. There's all these structures, there's hierarchies of power. At the top, you might have a dictator, but underneath him, you've got a next layer of a couple generals. And then even more generals under them, and even more generals under them. And at some point, it's not a lot different than in a democracy. Except you don't get a vote, you got to vote with your willingness to fight. Right? But if in a democracy or in any country we have corruption at the top and the layers beneath it don't start doing something about it, we all end up being responsible for it. We all end up paying the price. We all pay the price for our lack of attention to what our leaders are doing and for the lack of holding them accountable. Say, well, we can't because, the people always outnumber the government. And at some point, the soldiers are taken from among the people and the generals from among the soldiers and the higher government officials from among them or from among the powerful. At some point, at some level, everyone's responsible. We're responsible for being cowardly. We're responsible for putting up with treachery. In government, putting up with corruption. And so when the trouble comes because of it, we all can pay the price. The Lord is merciful. The Lord can grant, be gracious to us. Lord, be gracious. We've been waiting for you. You look at Isaiah, he was prophesying. For him to survive and to say all these things, you can be sure he had some supporters. God occupies the high ground. He always dwells on the high place. He is the highest authority of all. That's always the message, that God is over kings. That's why Jesus is called King of Kings and Lord of Lords. That even kings got to bow to God's righteous ways. Even kings, even absolute rulers are subject to the righteous standards of God. That they should obey the truth. That they should have the best interests of their people in mind. And those always run in terms of, you know, giving them the ability to pursue the necessities of life, which means economic freedom. And they need political freedom too. They need to be able to assess their leaders. The leaders have to be responsive. Even an absolute monarch has to be responsive to the needs of his people and to hear their complaints. God is exalted. He is on high. He is above everything, the judge of everything. And wisdom and knowledge shall be the stability of thy times. I mean, you want to have stable times. Your times are going to be governed through wisdom and knowledge. It's very important that we, you know history, learn from history. That we learn, the examples given in the Bible, the history given is so informative of what can happen. You know, and the plea never goes away. That we should hear this and not descend into chaos as they descend into chaos, following after evil things, following after treachery and spoil. I mean, but the idea that wisdom and knowledge should bring about stability shouldn't be earth-shaking. But I think a lot of times the big argument is over, well, what's wisdom, what's knowledge? You know, sometimes I feel like in our time, people are more willing to believe in their fantasies. They're more willing to believe in what they want to be true than in just really submitting themselves to what's actually true. And to following after the things of God with a sincere heart as opposed to, you know, using it for our own purposes. And so many people use, you know, it's like it says in 2 Peter 2, you know, by reason of whom the way of truth shall be evil spoken of. They're profiting, they make merchandise of you, and that's why people speak evil of the way of truth. It's like people spoke evil of God's people. But the Lord will cleanse his holy mountain, he will cleanse his people. Strength of salvation. So, wisdom and knowledge shall be stability of thy times and strength of salvation. To make our salvation strong. You know, I did a study called Justifiable Confidence of Salvation. It's rather lengthy, but you know, the point is there's a lot to know. There's a lot of things you could believe about Jesus. I mean, there's so much. The Bible's a big book. It's not even a book. It's books. It's got all these different books in it. We got the book of Isaiah, the gospel, the different gospels are all books to themselves. People always just talk about the Bible like it's just one thing, but it's many things. Just like the common Christian Bible is 66 separate books. They're not all super long, but it's 66 different books. There's various authors. Though some of them, there's no single author necessarily, like the Psalms. There's multiple authors of the Psalms. It's not just all David. There's Asaph, there's David, there's Hezekiah, and whoever else. Some of them are probably anonymous. They just not said who wrote it. There's so much to be learned from that collective wisdom that God inspired. And you want to be strong in terms of salvation. Fill yourself with knowledge and wisdom. Knowledge is just the facts of what, how to do things, you know, right? And wisdom is sort of what gives you the ability to act the right way at the right time, I guess. I mean, I'm not going to say that's, don't take a note on that and say that's what Paul's, the difference between wisdom and knowledge. But wisdom, I guess, I always look at wisdom as the ability to sort of figure things out, new things. To take knowledge and apply it to a situation, you know. Like, I like to think of knowledge in terms of, yes, there's things you learn. But it's not just like facts and figures in your head. You know, there's a knowledge that can be learned physically. Like, I can play the guitar. And my brain has been programmed, my hands, to do certain things without even thinking about it. You know, it's very deeply embedded in my mind. The shapes of the chords, I just think A, and my fingers leap into the positions. I don't have to think index finger to the second string, middle finger to the fifth string, second fret, and then the ring finger to the fourth string. I don't have to think about all that stuff. I just do it. And I think there's a knowledge of righteousness also, that you just do what's right because you know what's right. But there are situations where you don't know what's right. You don't know what to do. And that's where wisdom is very important, very crucial. You know, a lot of things that are matters of conscience got to be decided by wisdom. And also, you know, when it comes to being gracious to people or not, it's got to be decided by wisdom. It's got to be figured out using wisdom. We can have a lot of knowledge, but if we don't have the wisdom of how to properly use that knowledge, like for instance, I may know some facts and figures about the Bible, but if I don't have the wisdom not to just batter people with it, who are, you know, just trying to figure things out and I'm just hammering them, they're not ready for it. Meaning it's not a debate. Someone's just curious, but I'm turning it into a debate because I got a point to make. I don't do that, but I've seen it done. I was probably guilty of that when I was younger. The fear of the Lord is his treasure. That goes back. The reason I read all that way is the noise of the tumult. Fearing God is a treasure. When you lose fear of God, you lose a lot. And I see it all the time in people who don't believe in God. Not saying that just because someone doesn't believe in God, they can't have a facsimile thereof. Meaning, I still want to do right, even though I'm not afraid of God. And when I say fear of the Lord, I don't necessarily mean afraid of God like, oh, he's out to get me. But it's understanding that God is the power. He is exalted. He loves righteousness. He loves holiness. Pleasing God is of paramount importance. Behaving in the upright way is very wise because he is to be feared. You know, I used the analogy when I had a downed power line. And I remember the electricity, the power line, you know, it has a ground and a hot cable. This was a power line going from one of my buildings to the other, very high voltage, you know, like a supply line. And it came down. And the wires were touching, and it was making this sound like zomp, zomp, and flashing this bright white light. And I knew that was dangerous. I knew that was dangerous. And I went to the Grand Canyon once, and I looked over the edge, and it was scary. I went up on my roof. Now, I was young then. I didn't used to be very intimidated by heights. I used to climb stuff and go up trees with chainsaws and stuff like that. But now I'm older, I've got children, and my mortality is a little more apparent to me. I'm not as agile as I once was, you know? And going up on the roof of the house when I did my roof a couple of years ago, I remember being pretty terrified, seeing that this is a pretty decent slope. It's not like a low slope like that house I grew up in. This has got a pretty decent, you know, old-fashioned slope. Not quite 45 degrees, but, you know, it was steep. A little bit of a slip, and you can have a chain reaction. In fact, I did have a point where I slipped, and I went right off the edge onto the scaffolding, which I had there for safety. But I lost control, and I went into a slide that I couldn't stop, and I hit the scaffolding, and I remember it rocked back and forth. And I thought, well, if it had tipped over, at least it would have gone into the bushes there. Probably would have gotten away with maybe, hopefully nothing more than a scratch or two. But what I'm saying is, because I know those things are so dangerous, I'm careful. You know, God is dangerous. He is so dangerous. You know, God is a dangerous, powerful thing. And to lightly consider, well, you know, God, what can he do? What can God do? He can do everything. But most of all, he can finish us off in a second. He can pull the plug like that. I don't want you to be thinking he's about to do it. God doesn't intercede like that very frequently. Certainly not in the lives of those who believe him. But I'll tell you what, the wicked get arrogant and defiant of God. And God may let them go on, you know. There's no guarantee he's going to do that. But that's not really my point. That like, oh, because be afraid, because if you mock God or something, he might just strike you down. That's not what I'm saying. Because you know what? Those people, whatever they do, I don't care. You know, they can mock God all they like, whatever. It's even funnier that he doesn't do anything. Because he's gracious. You know, and they say, oh, you know, God is so... You know, they say, the figure in the Old Testament, he's so vengeful and angry. And it's like, not really. Honestly, if you consider how much he put up with before he did what he did to Israel, he put up with a lot. Before they, and the point is, if he puts up with that forever, then you'll say he's terrible because he's impotent. He never does nothing about all the evil. His power is useless. But then I say he's dangerous, and they're, oh, are you trying to scare me with God? Not you, believer. Not even the unbeliever. The unbeliever's not scared. I don't care. But those of you who understand how dangerous God is and who fear him, in the sense of you understand how dangerous he is. God is dangerous. He's scary. I'm not afraid. I trust. You know? But that doesn't mean I don't have that fear. I know how powerful he is. And I want to please him. Not out of fear, but out of love, because I love him. It's like your father. When you look up a child who loves their father because he's so strong and powerful and scary. My kids would testify that I was a scary father. They've said it many times, but that doesn't mean they don't love me. Or that they hate me and they're terrified. They're scared because they know I'm scary. But not because I'm against them, you know. We're not to fear. The fear of the Lord is treasure, not because you think God is against you, but because you know what he's capable of. And it's a treasure because your respect for that power, by respecting God's power and how dangerous he is and all that, by respecting that, it empowers you to be a man of God or a woman of God or someone living a life that is going to be meaningful and filled with God's power. Because God doesn't give his power to those who fear him not. His power is going to flow into those who fear him, believe in him, and seek him, and wait for him. To wait for God, to fear God, and to wait for him, and to seek his power, to seek his strength, and that he would be your arm, and your salvation, and your wisdom, and knowledge, and all those things, that you would seek that. Those are the people who get rewarded with that. So the fear of the Lord is indeed a treasure. But let's move on. Verse 7. Behold, their valiant ones shall cry without. The ambassadors of peace shall weep bitterly. The highways lie waste. The wayfaring man ceaseth. He hath broken the covenant. He hath despised the cities. He regardeth no man. So what's this all mean? Well, the first part is easier, the verse 7. Their valiant ones shall cry without. The ambassadors of peace shall weep bitterly. You know, the ambassadors are seeking peace, but God has said no. Turmoil, war. I'm bringing about my judgment to bring about righteousness. I'm not going to let you have peace with wickedness anymore. I'm not going to let you have peace with treachery and spoil. I'm not sure exactly where this is referring to or who God's enemies. But historically, I'm saying, I can give you general principle. Sometimes I'm not sure exactly what Isaiah is talking about. Sometimes the translation, it leaves me a little bit sketchy. But, you know, when God has declared war, the ambassador peace are going to be frustrated. They're not going to have what they sought. The valiant ones, you know, the heroes, those who are ready to fight, are going to weep because all the fight's going to be taken away from them. The highways lie waste. That means they're desolate. They're not being used. the wayfaring man, the man who walks along the path, the traveler, ceases. And I don't know if this may refer to the instrument of God's punishment, the Assyrian. Breaking the covenant, breaking the peace treaty, perhaps, because the ambassadors of peace are weeping. Now, you make a peace treaty with a treacherous dealer, and this may refer back to, in fact, I think I highlighted this in the same color I highlighted the first verse, and all the in-between ones were not highlighted the same color. So I went back to the color because I think I was trying to draw a connection. Because this is the spoiler. The spoiler, right? Their valiant ones, I mean, they're going to be frustrated. The spoiler's going to be frustrated. You know, because here we see, you know, the highways waste, the wayfaring man ceaseth. That's obviously, like, you know, the ways of commerce and the freedom of movement are disrupted because of all the punishments being brought on and the disruptions of society that come about when things fall apart, when the unrighteousness comes to a certain point and everything starts to turn into chaos. You can't travel. It's too dangerous. You know, the covenant, the agreement that brings peace and that allows trade and prosperity and people to move about freely, when that all breaks down, you know, when the covenant, that sort of covenant, that implicit agreement of civil society, when law and order breaks down, you know, when people don't just sort of do what's right because it's what's expected, generally speaking, you know, you go to town and there aren't police everywhere. At least not where I live. Even in the cities and stuff, there's crime, right? But, you know, like if you go in your suburbs or whatever, you know, you go to the grocery store, there's not like a cop on every corner. A lot of what's keeping law and order is just people's agreement, the covenant, to just keep law and order. We all sort of keep it. We all participate. Yet despise the cities. He regardeth no man. Cities always end up worst off. They end up places of horror. Those are the places where people look to, you know, conquer the cities. All the nukes are trained on the cities. Verse 9, the earth mourneth and languisheth. Lebanon is ashamed and hewn down. Sharon is like a wilderness, and Bashan and Carmel shake off their fruits. You know, that is the natural world now, whether through symbology or whatever, is brought in. You know, Lebanon was the place where the cedars and a lot of the source of the lumber that they used for their building. You see, it's all cut down. And maybe they come in to build their machinery of war, who knows? But whenever there's war and turmoil, you know, the natural world becomes polluted and destroyed. You know, trees hewn down, rivers and streams polluted with human waste and rotting carcasses. And the fields that should be planted and beautiful are going wild. No one has time. They're, it's too dangerous to go out there. If you plant something and start to harvest, people will come and take it from you. That's what happens. When these things start to break down, people come and they take it from you. You try, oh, I'll just build a little field here, you know, and everyone's going to respect my field. When things are going well, when everyone's obeying righteousness, when the covenant is intact, right? When the covenant's intact, you just go out and build and plant and harvest, and people are just walk by and say, hey, and respect your right to pursue your goals in life, to plant your crops and harvest them, to enjoy the fruits of your labor. If you let things get out of control, they're just going to come and take it from you. And no one will bother to produce anything. You know, people just stop. Stop trying. Stop openly doing stuff. You ain't got to plant Sharon. You know, the fruits, no one's going to tend the fruit trees. Why bother? You tend them, then you come back and they've all been stolen. Verse 10. Now will I rise, saith the Lord. Now will I be exalted. Now will I lift up myself. Ye shall conceive chaff. Ye shall bring forth stubble. Your breath as fire shall devour you, and the people shall be as the burnings of lime. As thorns cut up shall they be burned in the fire. When God decides it's time to punish the world for their iniquity, it's easy burning. You know, when we don't follow the ways of God, when men do not follow the righteous path, the world itself can be turned into hell. When God rises up to show, this is what's right, you've been doing wrong, and here's what the consequences are. And we're saying that you're going to conceive chaff. Chaff is the fine particles that from harvesting. It's like the dust of wheat. It's like, you know, it's a very fine, just think of it as very fine grass. It's really dry. It's not really grass, though. Bring forth stubble. Very similar, you know, the straw dried out. Short straw. Your breath is fire. You know, you're bringing forth chaff, and your breath, your words, your life is fire to destroy all that your works have been. All the works you bring forth, you are going to be the undoing of all that you have built. That's what he's saying. And the people shall be as burnings of lime. That means fuel for the lime kiln. They're going to be fuel for the fire. As thorns cut up. Thorns burn easy. But we're going to make them burn even easier. We're going to cut up the thorns. Cut up thorns. You know, like you take kindling and you break it into smaller pieces to make it easy to start that fire. And if you built fire, I have. You know, you take the branches and you break them into nice small pieces. You make a nice pile and then you make a pile slightly bigger. And you're saying, you know, and anyway, if you've been around agriculture at all, you know that agricultural dust, like that fine particles, can be nearly explosive. I think it actually is, in fact, explosive. You can have grain elevator explosions. That's how inflammable this stuff is. And that's what's good. That's what happens to the people. They get burned up. And all you bring forth all these bad, unrighteous, wicked ideas into the world, and you conceive them, and they are so combustible. Now, this is a vision of like when wickedness begins to just eat itself up. Its own output is set on fire by its own output. Verse 13, hear ye that are far off what I have done, and ye that are near, acknowledge my might. That's what I say about the fear of the Lord. God has, he is mighty, powerful. And we ignore him at our peril. Humanity. Christian nation, whatever. No nation can long abide in wickedness. That's why there's such overturn. Because God hates it. Verse 14, the sinners in Zion are afraid. Fearfulness hath surprised the hypocrites. Who among you shall dwell with the devouring fire? Who among us shall dwell with the who among us shall dwell with the everlasting burnings? He that walketh righteously and speaketh uprightly, he that despiseth the gain of oppressions, that shaketh his hands from the holding of bribes, that stoppeth his ears from the hearing of blood, and shutteth his eyes from seeing evil, he shall dwell on high, and his place of defense shall be the munitions of rocks. Bread shall be given him, his waters shall be sure. That's the point. God, the sinners are going to be punished. The sinners in Zion are afraid. They've been doing evil. And now finally, after many warnings, the punishment of God is coming, and they're terrified. And the fearfulness has surprised, because, you know, honestly, the funny thing is they go down this path all the time, humanity, over and over again. And they're headed towards it, and they think, no, this time we can just do all these wicked things, and we got it fixed this time. We have a plan. It's all going to work out. We're gonna do it scientifically this time, or whatever. You know, we're gonna do it according to the new wisdom we have found, whereby we can do all these evil things, and there's gonna be no consequence for it. There's not gonna be any price to pay. And he's saying you will not dwell in the devouring fire. Who can abide this fire that comes? These hypocrites. And this word hypocrites is not the Greek word hypocrates. Hypocrites? I forget. The note I have here from my research in the Hebrew years ago was soiled. These filthy people. That's basically what it's saying. Who among you shall dwell with a devouring fire? Who among you shall, who among us? That's a question they should ask themselves. Who, how are we going to dwell in the everlasting burnings? Notice here, this is obviously not meant, this is referring to something that's very temporal. The idea of everlasting burnings, you know, God is an everlasting fire. His fire never goes out. He is always against evil. He is always ready to burn. He's always willing to burn it down. But he's gracious. He's patient. But he is the everlasting burning. The wickedness and evil and unrighteousness, it has a price that comes with it. And that is the burning. It gets burned up. And who's going to dwell among this everlasting? Who can dwell in everlasting burning? Well, he that walketh righteously, speaketh uprightly, speaks the right thing, speaks the truth. He that despises the gain of oppressions, you know, gaining through oppression, extortion. And also people getting rich by using the power of government to take their hard-earned. There's a certain amount of taxation that is absolutely necessary. I have no problem with that. I'm just saying there are some who would like to take in basically everything, and then they would decide. You know, they're growing again. The last century was called communism. And it's funny to me that I hear people espousing those ideas, which I thought were going to be dead forever. But that, you know, honestly, when you go away from God, it's not a far step till you start thinking of communism. You know why? Because we're smart. We can do it. We can just plan it all out. There won't be any extortion and bribes and all. No, not us. We're righteous. Or, well, you know, maybe not me, but, you know, the system will be all right. We'll have a good system. Whatever. They're going to devour themselves. They will start to eat themselves. I pray we not let them rise again as they did last century to kill hundreds of millions. Fearfulness has surprised the hypocrite. Okay, I went through that. But look at despising the gain of oppression. There's ways to gain through hard work, right? Through hard work and through diligence we can gain. But through just coming and taking the fruit of someone else's labor or by accusing them of having come by it in some dishonest way when it wasn't. You know, a lot of times you see people, they're wealthy, and people, they suggest that there's something wrong with that. I mean, as far as like, they built a business, they earned money. I'm not a wealthy person. I do not despise people. I'm a poor person. I don't despise people who have worked to earn whatever they got. You know, I mean, as a Christian, I got a different perspective on it, and the wealthy should be distributing and all that. That's what the Apostle Paul teaches, and that's fine. But it's another thing to go in and say, like, well, there's something wrong with them having been so successful. They must be cheating. And therefore, that justifies we're just going to take it and give it to people who don't do anything. That's oppression. This is my book. So, well, no, capitalism is oppression. Well, economic freedom is good. People should not, with good laws, people shouldn't be allowed to oppress each other. If someone voluntarily is buying a product that they want and that person gets wealthy off of that, you know, I would hope that person would have a giving spirit, but as far, or maybe reinvest it to make other people have jobs and be able to do things. I think of the parable of the workers' wages. You know, those guys all got jobs because somebody owned a field. Because he was tending his grapes. So he ended up hiring. That's good. That's not gain of oppression, hiring people what they're worth for a job, for what it's worth, for what that labor is worth. You know, where does the bribes go? Government. That's where the bribes come. Shakes his hands from holding, he won't take a bribe. You know, stops his ears from hearing of blood. That doesn't mean someone who ignores, like, oh, I don't want to hear about that. I want to turn a blind eye to all the wicked things that are going on in the world. That's not what it means. It's like he doesn't want to hear, we can kill him You know, what he's saying is like the, like plots to do murder and treachery. He will not hear of such things, a righteous man, to do wickedness such as that, to do violence, to gain advantage. And his eyes from seeing evil, meaning he just look on, the idea of that is to look on evil and not, well, hey, that's just, that's fine. That's just, hey, that's the way it is. You know, I see evil and I have no response. The shutting of eyes meaning that you do not want to see evil. You want to see right prevail. It's not from just like, I'm going to close my eyes and pretend it isn't happening. That's not what it means. I think anyone with sense would understand that. Verse 16, he shall dwell on high, and the place of defense shall be the munitions of rocks. You know, the Lord Jesus is the rock for all Christians. And anyone who would believe in him, he can be their rock. Right? He is the rock of our salvation. And, but what that means, though, aside from just saying, oh, it's Jesus, but it is our Lord. But he is our rock. But what does it mean that he is our rock? You know, the idea of munitions of rock, you know, it is the most defensible place. It means munitions means like a fastness, a fast place, a strong, secure place. That means, you know, what he's saying is he's going to have security. He's not like on sifting sand. Bread shall be given him. He will be supplied with the necessities of life, bread and water. His water shall be sure. You know, when you're under attack, nothing can be more important than a supply of food and especially of clean water. And what it's saying is the righteous man is going to have the most necessary things and he will prevail. You know, in the world, it's so important in a way that when you are a person who deals righteously with other men are more likely to deal righteously with you. And the treacherous dealers who deal treacherously, they're going to be found out and punished. And if that's not happening, we can't put up with it. We should not allow it to happen because then we become complicit. Christ is the rock. He is the bread of life. Right? He says, if you would ask me, he said to that woman at the well in the Gospel of John, he said, I would give you living water. And it would be in you a well of water springing up into everlasting life. Verse 17, thine eyes shall see the king in his beauty. They shall behold the land that is very far off. That ideal state, the beautiful king. The promised king, he will be the king. Wonderful Counselor, the Mighty God, the Everlasting Father. Unto us a child is born, a son is given, the King of Kings, the Lord God of Hosts. The land that is far off, you know, we all, that makes me think of like Hebrews, you know. They were all strangers. They all sought a country. They were not mindful of the country. You know, they said, we are strangers. We're looking for our place. And they weren't mindful of where they came from, but where they were going. You know, we are going to a kingdom in which righteousness dwells. Therefore, in this world, the grace of God teaches us that denying ungodliness and worldly lust, we should live righteously, soberly, and godly. Right now in this present world. Titus chapter 2. The grace of God gives us the power to achieve that to greater and greater degree as we continue in it, as we become more and more conformed to the likeness of Christ. And then we dwell in the sure place. We have the bread. We have the water. And our enemies will not be able to confound us. And we will see, we will have the vision of God. We will see the king in his beauty. We will see the land that is far off, the promised land, the promised place of security. The promised place of peace. Verse 18. Thine heart shall meditate terror. Where is the scribe? Where is the receiver? Where is he that counted the towers? Thou shalt not see a fierce people, a people of a deeper speech than thou canst perceive, of a stammering tongue that thou canst not understand. That goes back to chapter 28 where he was saying you're going to see a people who have a stammering lips and another tongue. And that's how I'm going to talk to you. I'm going to talk to you through the lips of your conquerors, the Assyrians. But here he's saying, no, those, you're going to think about this terror that's come about. You're going to think about it because you're not going to be suffering it. You're going to meditate on the terrors. And you're going to think, where is that scribe? You know, where is the receiver? Which the word means to suspend or poise, especially in trade. A trader. Where is the scribe? Where is the trader? Where is he that counted the towers? And say, well, let's count the towers. You know, right? Let's see how much weapons we got. They think that all these weapons, that the scribe is the power of the knowledge, religion, false religion probably. You know, the scribes of evil things. You know, the university, the economy, and the military. You know, you're going to meditate on how the learned men were not able to save us, the economic powers were not able to save us, and the military powers were not able to save us when God decides that we're too wicked to be worth saving as far as the nation. But you, who are righteous and who follow the Lord, who wait upon Him, you're going to meditate on all the terrors that come upon all these things. You're going to say, where are they? What happened? And we're not going to see the fierce people. We're going to see the goodness of God. We're going to see the King in His beauty. We're going to behold the land that is afar off. And He's saying He's going to be gracious with those who wait for Him. Look upon Zion, the city of our solemnities. Verse 20. Thine eyes shall see Jerusalem, a quiet habitation, a tabernacle that should not be taken down. Not one of the stakes thereof shall ever be removed, neither shall any of the cords thereof be broken. But the glorious Lord will be unto us a place of broad rivers and streams, wherein shall go no galley with oars, neither shall gallant ship pass thereby. For the Lord is our judge, the Lord is our lawgiver, the Lord is our King, He will save us. And, you know, the judge, the lawgiver, and the king, maybe that's more of what he had in mind with the scribe, the receiver, and he that counts the towers. I don't know. You know, he that counts on his defenses, maybe that refers to the king. And the receiver is some sort of lawyer. I don't know. But I don't mind the interpretation I gave, but here I see three again, and I sort of wonder, you know, where are these people who are supposed to fulfill these roles? Well, we have God, the Lord. He is our judge, our lawgiver, and our king. So, going back, look upon Zion, the city of our solemnities. Thine eyes shall see Jerusalem, a quiet habitation, a tabernacle that shall not be taken down. Notice, it's interesting, he says, a tent that shall not be taken down. But Jerusalem isn't a tent. But he's, for God, it is like a tent. Because, you know, there's the heavenly Jerusalem. The Jerusalem is more than just the city. You know, the place with the solemnity, the quiet habitation, it's not the rocks and all that stuff. It is the Lord. And where the Lord is, there is the tabernacle of God, His tent. The tent, the reason it's a tent, because it is geographically movable. Yet here, it is permanent. The stakes of this tent are never to be removed. So it's a contradictory type idea. We have a tent, an inherently movable dwelling that is immovable. The spiritual Zion is this immovable thing, but yet is movable. Meaning it's a tent that never comes down. You always can inhabit it. You can always have a place in God's holy city. He never moves. His city never moves. They talk about it as a land that is afar off. Yet, it's right there, right in the midst of them. And the cords are not broken. The eternal city is eternal. Regardless of whatever happens around it, regardless of the men and the destruction that comes, that for the righteous, the city is never moved. It's always there. In a sense, Jerusalem has always endured. You know, there was a time when God pronounced that it would become a ruin during the Babylonian invasion. But there were also people around, still around. And Jerusalem was always there in their hearts. That's why he likens it to a tabernacle and not to a citadel. Because the citadel was destroyed, but the tabernacle never came down. And to that, I regard that as the spiritual. So, but the glorious Lord shall be unto us a place of broad rivers and streams. Wherein shall go no galley with oars, neither shall a gallant ship pass thereby. So the idea is that the Lord is this river and stream, a place of broad rivers and streams. See, he's using symbolic language. The tabernacle of God, Jerusalem, is not taken down. But there, the Lord is unto us a place of broad rivers and streams. That's obviously a spiritual idea. No galley with oars. You know, no proud ships passing by. You know, man's not going to use God for man's own ends. That the power that God brings to us, the spiritual nourishment that he affords us, can't be used by the enemy to come upstream and harm us. He is our judge, our lawgiver, our king. He will save us. He will save us. We look to, you know, there's all kinds of things people want. Look to man, to judge, to give legal things. But ultimately, our judge, our lawgiver, our king is the Lord. Men will institute unjust laws. Men will do evil things in the name of the people, of the government, of God. But God himself is unmoved. He is always where he is, in his holy place. Verse 23, thy tacklings are loosed. They could not well strengthen their mast. They could not spread the sail. Then is the prey of the great spoil divided. The lame take the prey. See, here's saying like there's like these ships that cannot pass God's holy river. Right? And then they're using all this nautical terms of the tacklings and their mast, and they could not spread the sail. I mean, they want to use these things to come up river to God's people. But instead, it sounds like they kind of make shipwreck. I think that's an implication, because then there's a prey of a great spoil. You know, their ship is sunk. The enemies of God, their ship is sinking. Because, you know, what other kind of prey would be available to the lame? Meaning, they're in such a position of weakness and destruction that they can be spoiled by the lame ones. And this goes back to verse 1. Thou who spoilest and thou wast not spoiled. Well, you're getting spoiled now. The Lord will provide for his people through the destruction of the wicked. 24, and the inhabitants shall not say, I am sick. The people that dwell therein shall be forgiven their iniquity. The word sick here, I think, would be better translated afflicted. It means to be, the literal meaning is like to be rubbed or worn, and thereby, you know, I'm all worn out, I'm worn down, I'm afflicted, or perhaps sick, I'm ill, I'm not well. And one of the greatest sicknesses that comes on man is sin, the sickness of sin. To be, you know, because when you're sick with an illness, you know, you don't have the power to do your normal things. You lose your strength, maybe you run a fever, something else gets a hold of you and starts controlling your body, changing things, making your body do things that your will cannot control. And sin can be like that. Iniquity, you know, the deep iniquity of the heart. All those things. When we put our trust in the Lord, when we look to him, when we make him our king, our lawgiver, and our judge, the enemies, they're gonna fall apart. They're gonna try to sail upstream, and they're gonna be taken apart at the seams. It's just gonna be a great spoil, that's all. All that effort's gonna amount to zero. And those who inhabit God's place, those who inhabit his land, you know, the place of broad rivers and streams, they're not going to say, oh, I'm worn out, I got no power, I'm sick. I'm afflicted. Now, the people that dwell therein, in God's place, the place of broad rivers and streams, they're going to be forgiven their iniquity. And they will be able to walk in uprightness, with God having forgiven their sins. And you say, well, I don't understand. Why are the sinners being afraid and punished? Because there are unrepentant sinners who work wickedness to a high degree, thinking, who sees us and who knows us? Then there are those of us who want to do right, and we are human, we are weak, we are frail. God is gracious, and he sees that. He sees our hearts, and he knows we want to do right. You know? And that's very important. That's part of what believing in Jesus is all about, because Jesus was a preacher of righteousness. He preached righteousness, that men should do right things. You listen to the Sermon on the Mount. You know, when he talks about adultery, he's saying it's more important than just technically not doing adultery. And when it's murder, it's more than technically not doing murder. There's a higher standard he calls us to. And it was to ferret out the iniquity of hypocrisy, whereby people would say, like, well, I'm not a murderer, but I hate these people. You know, and they justify themselves. Well, I'm not an adulterer, but hey, look at that. You know, there is a degree to which people will justify themselves and think like they are doing right. But God is not pleased with that kind of hypocrisy. He wants us to speak the truth and to be honest about ourselves to ourselves. And if we seek the Lord and love righteousness and hate iniquity, when we come into his place of blessing, we're not going to be sick. We're not going to be impeded by iniquity, but he's going to bless us and turn us from our iniquity and forgive us our iniquity. And first of all, he forgives us. You know, that's the message of Jesus, that God, you know, Jesus came to lay his life down that we might be forgiven and that we could pursue righteousness with that clean slate. And it's important that we need to be forgiven. In the Old Testament, they needed to be forgiven too. And it always required God's grace. Always, always. It's throughout the prophets. Anyways, that concludes our study in Isaiah chapter 33. This is Line by Line Bible Studies. My name is Paul Strangini. Thank you for joining me. You can listen to all my studies on oraclesofgod.org, oraclesofgod.org. Thank you for joining me in this study. I look forward to studying with you again very soon.